All right, let's start with a little thought experiment. Imagine you're tasked with writing the definitive biography of, I don't know, a world-changing historical figure. You want the facts, the timeline, the absolute truth. Logically, what do? You write one book, you fact-check it, you harmonize everything, and you publish the single authoritative account. That would be the efficient way.
It would, yeah. I mean, it would certainly be the most efficient way to convey data if you were writing a textbook or maybe a Wikipedia page, absolutely.
But that is so not what we have with the foundational texts of Christianity. We don't have one super gospel.
Not at all.
We have four: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And for, what, 2,000 years, people have scratched their heads and asked this deceptively simple question. Why? Why four separate accounts? They sometimes overlap, sometimes contradict, and have totally different vibes. If the goal was just history, isn't four a bit inefficient?
Right.
Or just plain confusing?
It's a fantastic question. And honestly, it's the hook for this whole deep dive today. We aren't looking at these texts as just history, and we're definitely not here to argue theology or doctrine.
I'm checking the sermons at the door.
Exactly. Instead, we are unpacking this really fascinating piece of work. It's called From Separation to Union. Mm. It's written by a Dr. Bachara Saheeli. And here's the twist that got my attention right away. Mm. Dr. Saheeli isn't a theologian.
No.
He's a physician, an internal medicine specialist.
Which I think is so cool. It just brings a totally different energy to the room. Usually when we talk about ancient texts, we're thinking dusty libraries, maybe some elbow patches. But this guy, he deals with bodies, disease, healing.
Exactly. And he brings a diagnostic sensibility to the Gospels.
Yeah.
He argues that the reason there are four, well, it isn't because the editors were sloppy or, you know, couldn't decide on a final draft. It's because the subject matter, the human condition, and the healing of the human soul is just too complex for a single angle.
Mm-hmm.
He suggests these aren't just competing stories. They're four complementary lenses that create a complete map of the human journey.
A map. I like that. It implies we're actually going somewhere. So the mission for this deep dive is to read that map. We're going to explore these texts through the specific frameworks the author uses. And he uses two big terms, internal non-dual and mythopoetic.
That's right. And the promise of this deep dive is to show how Dr. Saheeli uses these frameworks to diagnose the fundamental human problem, what he calls separation, and then offer a sort of treatment plan toward union.
Okay, hold on. Let's pause right there. Integral, non-dual, and mythopoetic. My brain is already trying to shut down. Those sound like words you use to win a Scrabble game, not things regular people talk about. We need a plain English translation before we go any further. So let's start with integral and non-dual. What does that actually mean?
It sounds intimidating, I know, but it's actually quite intuitive once you strip away the jargon. Integral just means we're looking at the whole picture connecting the inner life with the outer life. But non-dual is the sticky one. In Western culture, we're trained to see everything in dualities, good versus evil, divine versus human.
He versus you.
Sacred versus secular. Me versus you. We see them as opposites that just never touch.
Right. God is up in the clouds. I'm down here stuck in traffic. Church is for Sunday morning, but cutthroat business is for Monday morning.
Precisely. That is a dualistic view, a non-dual reading. It challenges the illusion of that absolute separation.
Wait, let me play devil's advocate for a second. If you say non-dual, does that mean everything is just the same? Like, is good the same as evil? Is a murderer the same as a saint because we're all one, because that sounds dangerous?
And that is the most common misunderstanding. Non-dual doesn't mean monism or that everything is some homogeneous soup. Distinctions still exist. A healthy cell is distinct from a cancer cell. But they are part of the same body. Non-dualism is about seeing the underlying unity that connects those opposites. It's the idea that the divine isn't just out there across a chasm. It's the ground of being that permeates everything in here, too. It's about realizing the walls we build are mental constructs, not reality.
So it's not about erasing the lines between things, but realizing the lines are permeable.
Exactly. It's about connection rather than division.
Okay, that makes more sense. Now, what about mythopoetic? Because in 2024, when we say myth, we usually mean fake news. Like, oh, that's just a myth. Ignore it.
And that is a tragedy of modern language. We've really lost the nuance. In this context, and historically, myth doesn't mean falsehood. It means depth language. Dr. Saheeli points out that some truths, the most important ones, are just too deep for a spreadsheet or a literal description. They can only be expressed through story, symbol, archetype.
Like poetry. You don't read a poem to find out what the weather is. You read it to find out how the weather feels.
Right. And when we read the Gospels mythopoetically, we treat them as sacred drama. We aren't just asking, did this exact event happen in year 33 AD? We're asking, is this archetype playing out in the human soul right now? The journeys, the healings, the struggles, they mirror our own internal landscape.
And that's where the physician angle really kicks in for me. If these are archetypes of the soul, then Dr. Saheeli is basically doing rounds. He's diagnosing us.
Yes. He isn't looking at these texts to prove a doctrine to win an argument. He's looking for a cure. He treats the Gospels as a prescription for the human condition of alienation.
Okay, so let's look at the prescription. The book treats the four Gospels like a mandala, the sort of circular, complete symbolic pattern. Each Gospel is a specific voice or lens that provides a necessary piece of the treatment plan. If you lose one, the cure doesn't work.
Correct. You can't flatten them into one story without losing the medicinal value of each perspective.
Let's walk through the rounds. Patient chart number one, Matthew. In this framework, what's the vibe of Matthew?
Matthew is the voice of continuity. The archetype here is the wise king and lawgiver. If you open Matthew, what's the first thing you see? A massive list of names, a genealogy. Abraham begat Isaac, Isaac begat Jacob, on and on.
Which is usually the part where I start skimming.
Most of us do. But mythopoetically, that list is crucial. It addresses our deep primal need for roots. Matthew is constantly saying, this was done to fulfill what was spoken by the prophets. It connects the present moment to the ancient past.
So it's grounding. It's telling you that you aren't just floating in a vacuum.
Exactly. The key takeaway for the Matthew lens is that meaning is rooted in lineage. It reassures us that nothing essential is ever lost. It's just transfigured. It's the feeling that you are part of a story that started thousands of years before you were born. It offers security and structure.
Which is comforting. We all want to know we belong to something bigger, but then you turn the page to Mark, and honestly, it feels like someone changed the channel to a gritty action movie.
It really does. If Matthew is the slow, majestic history, Mark is the emergency room. It's the shortest gospel. It's kinetic. It's urgent. The word immediately appears constantly. Immediately, the spirit drove him. Immediately, he healed.
No time for genealogies. We've got stuff to do.
And the tone is so much darker. The archetype here is the hero's descent into the shadow. Mark doesn't sugarcoat anything. This is the narrative of the suffering Messiah. It confronts you, the reader, with fear, abandonment, silence.
The disciples in Mark are, well, they aren't the A-team. They never seem to understand what's going on. They're confused, afraid, bickering.
They are us. And consider the ending of Mark, the original ending. It doesn't end with a happy reunion or a big celebration. It ends with the women finding the empty tomb and then fleeing in terror and saying nothing to anyone because they were afraid. Cut to black.
That is a massive cliffhanger. It's almost disturbing.
It is, and Dr. Saheeli argues that's the point. Mark forces us to sit in the ambiguity. The key insight here is that transformation isn't about bypassing the darkness. It requires passing through it. Mark creates a container for our suffering and says, this too is part of the path. You can't have the resurrection without the descent.
That is heavy. It's the lens we probably want to avoid, but maybe the one we need the most when things fall apart. Okay, so we've got the king and the suffering hero. Next up is Luke. What is Dr. Saheeli's read on Luke?
Luke is the healer, which is fitting because tradition says Luke was a physician himself. If Matthew's about law and Mark is about suffering, Luke is about reversal. He is constantly widening the circle.
So this is the social justice lens.
In a spiritual sense, yes. Luke's narrative foregrounds the outsider, the poor, the women, the social outcasts, the Samaritans. Think about the parable of the Good Samaritan. We hear it so often it loses its punch. But in that context, making a Samaritan the hero was offensive. It was like making the hero a member of an enemy political party that you despise.
So it's designed to shock you out of your tribalism.
Exactly. It flips the script. The lowlies are lifted up. The powerful are brought down. Mythopoetically, this is about the reweaving of the human family. Hmm. It's a diagnosis that says our sickness comes from exclusion. And the cure is a radical inclusion. It's about realizing that the person you think is other is actually your neighbor.
So we have the wise king for our roots, the suffering hero for the shadow, and the healer for community. That leaves John. And John is, well, John is the trippy one.
Trippy is one way to put it. John is certainly distinct. It's high altitude theology. It's less chronological and much more symbolic. The archetype here is union and revelation.
This is in the beginning was the word stuff. It feels more abstract.
It is cosmic. The key concept in John is abiding, the idea that the boundary between heaven and earth is permeable. In the other Gospels, Jesus speaks in parables, short sayings. In John, he gives these long, flowing discourses about, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me, and I in you.
It sounds like a flow state.
That's a great comparison. It represents the ultimate goal of the map, cosmic union. It's not about a distant god sending a memo. It's about a mutual indwelling. It's the realization that the separation never really existed.
So if we put this whole matrix together, Matthew gives us our roots, Mark forces us to face our pain, Luke heals our relationship with others, and John connects us to the divine source.
Precisely. And Dr. Sangeli's core argument is that you need all four for a complete treatment. If you only have Matthew, you become rigid and legalistic. If you only have Mark, you might despair in the suffering. If you only have Luke, it might just become social activism without any spiritual depth. And if you only have John, you kind of float away into abstract mysticism and forget to feed the hungry.
It's a balanced diet for the psyche. You need the protein, the veggies, the water.
That's it.
Okay, so those are the tools. Now let's get back to the medical chart. Dr. Sahili says these texts diagnose a specific chronic human condition. He calls it separation. Let's dig into that. What does he mean by the myth of exile?
This is the heart of the non-dual reading. The diagnosis is that we feel like isolated subjects in a hostile world. We feel separate from nature, separate from each other, and separate from the divine.
It's that 3 a.m. feeling, isn't it? You can have the job, the house, the family, but you're staring at the ceiling thinking, am I actually known? Does any of this matter? It's a profound loneliness.
It is. It's a spiritual estrangement. Dr. Sahili calls it the myth of exile, this pervasive, low-level anxiety that says, I don't fully belong here. I'm not safe. I have to defend myself.
And because that feeling is terrifying, we try to self-medicate.
We do. And this is where the physician's diagnosis gets sharp. He talks about the failure of substitutes. We try to bridge that gap of separation with substitutes. Power, status, money, moral superiority, even religious performance.
If I just get that promotion, I'll feel secure. Or if I follow all the rules, God has to protect me.
Exactly. We build these fortresses to keep the feeling of separation at bay. But here's the twist in the diagnosis. The source argues that the people who appear the healthiest by worldly standards, the ones with the most control, the most success, the most righteousness, they're often the hardest to treat.
Because their defenses are working.
Because their defenses mask the condition. They think they don't need a doctor.
Yeah.
Whereas the broken ones in the gospel stories, the lepers, the tax collectors, the desperate parents, they're closer to transformation. Why? Because they have no defenses left. Their illusion of control has already shattered.
That is such a powerful flip. It's like, if you break your leg, you know you need help. But if you have a silent heart condition, you might run a marathon and drop dead. So the brokenness is actually an opening.
It makes you porous. It allows reality and grace to get in.
So if the disease is separation and the symptoms are these failed substitutes, what's the cure? The book talks about a shift from authority to participation. That sounds a bit academic. Break that down for us.
This is the move from the external to the internal. A lot of religion and society in general operates on external authority. Do this, don't do that. Check the boxes, and you'll be rewarded. It's transactional.
Compliance. It's like paying your taxes so you don't go to jail.
Compliance. But Dr. Sahili argues the Gospels aren't asking for compliance. They're asking for metanoia.
That's the Greek word usually translated as repentance, right? Which usually makes people think of a guy on a street corner with a megaphone yelling, repent.
Exactly. And that's such a mistranslation of the intent. Metanoia literally means a change of mind or a shift in perception. It's seeing the world with new eyes.
So the cure isn't about behaving better so the big boss upstairs likes you. It's about waking up.
Waking up to a union that is already there, but you just haven't recognized it. Salvation, in this integral non-dual view, isn't a transaction where you buy a ticket to heaven. It's an awakening to the fact that you were never actually separate from the source. Mm-hmm. It's shifting from, I am a separate ego trying to survive, to, I am a participant in the divine life.
And this totally reframes the idea of suffering, too, because usually we think suffering means something has gone wrong or that we're being punished.
Right. And we have to be very careful here. The non-dual view isn't that suffering is good or that we should seek it out, but it recognizes suffering as a mechanism. It's the crucible where the shell of the separate ego cracks open.
It's the Markan lens all over again.
Yes. Dr. Sahili writes about the cross not as a defeat, but as the moment where the hero enters the world's estrangement fully. By entering the darkest part of human experience, death and abandonment, and holding on to love within it, the separation is transformed from within.
It's like, if you run from the darkness owns you. But if you stand in it and keep your heart open, you change the nature of the darkness itself.
That is a beautiful way to put it.
I want to push back on one thing, though. The book talks about how this changes prayer moving from petition to participation.
Mm.
But isn't petition natural? If my kid is sick, I'm going to ask God to heal them. Is Dr. Saley saying that's wrong? That we shouldn't ask for things?
It's not that it's wrong, but that it's a starting point, not the destination. The vending machine model of prayer. I put in a coin of faith, I get out a miracle. That reinforces separation. It assumes God is over there and needs to be convinced to come over here.
Okay, I see that.
As you move toward union, prayer evolves into participation. It becomes a practice of aligning yourself with reality. You might still pray for your sick child, absolutely. But the energy shifts from, please fix this because you are far away, to, I am joining my love with your love for this child. It's a practice of remembering unity. You aren't just asking, you are tuning yourself to the frequency of the divine life that is already flowing.
That feels much more active. You're not just a beggar, you're a co-worker.
Precisely. And that leads to the final piece of the puzzle, living the pattern. Because you can't just sit in a room, read about union, and call it a day. You have to live it.
And this is where it gets messy, because living it involves other people.
The school of communion, as Dr. Salili calls it.
I love that phrase, but I hate the reality of it. It's easy to feel spiritual when you're meditating on a mountaintop. It's really hard when your neighbor decides to use a leaf blower at 7 a.m. on a Saturday.
Or when a colleague steals credit for your work. But the book argues that friction is the curriculum. You can't be non-dual in isolation. You need community, because community is where your illusions of being nice and patient get exposed.
So the annoyance is the point.
The annoyance is the invitation. When you react with anger or judgment, it shows you where you are still clinging to separation, where you are still protecting your ego. Reconciliation is the practice of overcoming that separation in real time.
This connects to ethics, right? Because sometimes religious ethics just feel like a list of don'ts, don't do this, don't touch that.
This framework flips that too. Ethics aren't rules you follow to avoid punishment. They are the natural expression of union. Think about it. Why don't you punch yourself in the face?
Because it would hurt. And it's my face.
Exactly. You have an internal sense of union with your own body. Dr. Saheeli argues that when you truly see through the lens of union, you realize the other is part of the same body. Compassion becomes a reflex, not a duty. You treat others well not because a book says so, but because you recognize them as yourself.
That is a massive shift. It moves from obeying the law to just being healthy.
Which brings us right back to the physician. Health isn't a rule, it's a state of being.
So bringing it all back home, we started with the question of why we have four gospels. And the answer isn't inefficiency. It's that we need a complete map. We need the roots of Matthew, the raw honesty of Mark, the radical inclusion of Luke, and the cosmic vision of John to tell the whole story.
The story of moving from alienation to communion, from feeling like an exile to finding home.
And what I find really compelling, and maybe a little daunting, is the conclusion that the gospels are unfinished.
That is the vital final point. These texts aren't just records of what happened to Jesus. They are a blueprint for what is happening in us. The story is unfinished because we are the current chapter.
Yeah.
The movement from separation to union is happening right now, in our lives, in our struggles, in our 7 a.m. leaf blower moments.
It's not a script you read. It's a script you act out.
It invites you not to watch, but to enter.
Which leaves us with a pretty big question to chew on. And this comes straight from that mythopoetic lens we talked about.
If the gospel story is indeed a map of the human psyche, the question is, where are you on that map right now?
Yeah. Think about that for a second. Are you in the structure of Matthew, maybe searching for your roots or trying to find order in chaos? Or are you in the descent of Mark, facing a shadow or a struggle that feels overwhelming, waiting for a dawn that hasn't come yet?
Or maybe you're in the healing circle of Luke, challenged to forgive someone you don't want to forgive, or learning to welcome the parts of yourself you've rejected? Or are you in the abiding of John, sensing a moment of deep connection and peace?
Wherever you are on the map, the message of Dr. Saheeli's book seems to be, you're on the path. The diagnosis has been made, but the shelling is a journey.
A journey from separation to union.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
It was a pleasure.
We'll see you on the next one.